This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was Dr. Jeffrey Nagel, the president and CEO of the Erickson Institute. His topic was the first 1,100 days last forever, or the period from birth or when we're carried in our mother's womb to 3 years old is the key to determining much of what will happen to us throughout life. Dr. Nagel is a pioneer in the field of early childhood development and education, and the Erickson Institute, for more than 50 years, has worked with Chicago Public Schools. They provide mental health counseling for children and families. They work with political leaders to expand services and education for young children. At Erickson, Dr. Nagel has championed new projects that are exploring technology use among young children, determining whether mindfulness strategies mitigate toxic stress among Chicago public school students, opening up access to quality mental health services to families in the Little Village neighborhood, and training policymakers on early childhood issues. Dr. Nagel said, "Genes load the gun, but experience pulls the trigger. From birth to our third birthday, this is the foundation of our lives for us and for our children."
Good afternoon, everyone. So we have heard for years that disparities or gaps in educational achievement exist because of our schools. But the reality is that disparities exist not because of the schools, but because of what happens or doesn't happen before a child ever enters school. Disparities are evident by kindergarten, and in fact, in many cases, are evident by as early as 2 years of age. So when I talk about early childhood, I'm really talking about early experience, because early experience is the smoking gun for both educational success and health outcomes, right? The two biggest areas that we spend our public dollars, because ultimately what happens early in life leaves biological memories in your body. So that old saying of it gets under your skin, well, that in fact is exactly what happens. And that's what we'll explore a little bit today. So when we talk about the brain, right, you hear a lot about, oh, the brain is, 85% developed, by 3 years of age. Mm-hmm. It's not just how developed it is. It's all about the connections. So when we think about the seven major stages of brain development, they all begin prenatally. Those first four are completely done by the time the child is born. So you're talking about those last three there, the connections and the pruning, which connections you're left with. So if we looked at that left side of the slide is kind of the number of connections you'd have when you're born, and then you have this exuberance of connections being made, because when you're born, you have 100 billion neurons, and by the time you're three, you might have 900 trillion connections. So that's anywhere from 40,000 a second up to estimates of 1 million connections being made each second. And so for those of you who remember dealing with babies, or if you have a baby at home, you see that almost happening, like everything coming together in the child's brain. But ultimately, it's the name of the game isn't the number of connections, it's the right connections. And you prune away the connections that you don't use and you don't need. It's a simple use it or lose it. And how you do that is all based on the experience of the child. Because ultimately, the brain changes its structure and function based on the experiences it has. So we think of it as having plasticity or neuroplasticity. And we all intuitively know this, which is why we want to give our children or our nieces and nephews or grandchildren the most positive experiences they can have, the most nurturing, stimulating experiences. Because we also understand that the flip side is true, that negative experiences will have very negative impact on the child. So when we think about things that are toxic, right? We think lead or mercury, and we get it. We don't want that near our children at all. But we also need to think about stress, which is very hard to think about our children being stressed. We think about childhood as a time of no stress, and we'll take care of everything for them. What do they have to be stressed about? But in reality, children are stressed too, right? They come out of the womb screaming and crying. They are stressed out after that ride. And they cry so perfectly that you cannot ignore that cry, right? You have to respond to that cry. That's all biologically wired in us to do that. Now, hopefully, how you respond to the cry is what's important, but you cannot ignore that. And so for children, there's tolerable stress, a dirty diaper, hungry, tired, whatever the case may be, and a caring adult comes to them, picks them up, nurtures them, gives them a bottle, helps them fall asleep, sings them a lullaby, all of that, right? So their kind of alarm system, their stress response system goes off, and then they get to a calming state. And they learn that's the way the world works. But for too many of our children, they're dealing with toxic stress, unremitting, unrelenting stress that is kind of an alarm that is always going off. So this comes with, you know, extreme poverty, violence in the home, exposure to violence, mental health issues in the home, substance abuse. And that's not an exhaustive list, but the idea is that these things often travel in a pack. And it's not a bad day or a bad week. It's bad months, it's bad year, it's a bad period of life. And that's really toxic stress. Now, to really understand the impact of that, think about what stress does in your life, right? Without you even thinking about it, if you're stressed out, you're going to have increased heart rate, increased blood pressure, increased respirations, you might get sweaty palms or butterflies in your stomach, right? That's all a natural physiological response to help you deal with the stress. Your stress response system activates and gets you ready to deal with that. And kind of the initial step in that is the secretion of a chemical or hormone in your body called cortisol. And this cortisol is going to go to the areas of your brain that's going to help you deal with that stress. But in doing that, there's a trade-off. The trade-off is it's going to suppress your immune system a little bit, right? So we know when you're really heavily stressed, you're more likely to get sick. Or if you have a chronic illness, your doctor's going to tell you you've got to reduce the stress in your life. If you have to remember something and it's really critical and stressing you out, how easy is it to remember that thing that is so stressful? Your attention, your ability to pay attention or your behavior, you get more nervous. That's all because your stress response system is activating to help you deal with the stress. So the same thing happens for young children if they're really stressed out. And what happens is in an early childhood setting, maybe in a childcare environment, that child who's chronically stressed, their level of cortisol in their system may become more permanently elevated, kind of like a new normal. And so that's the kid that we see that's more difficult to pay attention, more aggressive toward other kids, you know, over-aroused, overstimulated. And we label those kids often ADHD. But in reality, they're just dealing with a very stressful, scary world and environment that they live in. And to really bring this point home, this is the areas of the brain where that cortisol goes to help you deal with your anxiety and your fear, whether it's a child or an adult. Now, what's not important here is the names of these areas, but you see the areas that are circled here. And on the next slide are the areas of the brain that you use for memory and learning, what you would need to do to attend in school or a childcare setting to pay attention and learn. And what you see there is it's the exact same areas of the brain. That's why it is so hard when you're stressed out or anxious to attend to the tasks at hand and learn and remember and do all the things you need to do. Now, the importance of this really comes home from a seminal study from the late 90s called the Adverse Childhood Experiences. And this was a study of about 18,000 adults in Southern California who were part of the Kaiser Permanente Health Plan. This was mainly a white, a more middle, upper income group, educated, and they all had health insurance here in the late 90s. And they were asked which one of these 10 things did they have when they were children. And they would check off the boxes. So you could be in none of these, one of these, or even potentially all 10. And just because people always ask, this were the percentages of boxes that were checked. But essentially, one third had zero, and one in six had four or more, just to kind of summarize those results. And what they found was a direct dose-response relationship between the number of boxes you checked and your health outcomes on all of the major health illnesses, really, of our time, right? The number one health issue is heart disease, cancer, stroke, liver disease, etc. All of these a direct dose-response relationship with these bad things that happened to you as a young child. And so just to summarize some of the incredible findings, if you had a score of four or more, you were twice as likely to have cancer, seven times as likely to be an alcoholic. Six, if you had more than six, you were 30 times more likely to have attempted suicide. And if you had a score of seven or more, even if you did not drink or smoke and you were not overweight, you still had a 360% increased risk for heart disease. This was so profound that if you had that six or more score, your life expectancy was reduced by 20 years. So quite a profound impact from those negative experiences in life. So what that really tells you is that the many chronic diseases of adults are determined decades earlier in childhood, not by disease, but by life experience. So that adversity in childhood can literally kill you as an adult. Now, none of us wants bad things to happen to kids, but I remember hearing this research and thinking, how in the world does what happens to you in those early years literally lead you to heart disease, even if you eliminate things like your habits, like smoking and drinking, etc.? And that's where I think it just gets really fascinating to get into everyone's favorite subject, which is DNA and chromosomes. But if you look at certain areas, sections of the DNA at the end of each chromosome, this area called a telomere, right? So this is almost like, think of the cap at the end of your shoelace, right? That little plastic tip that keeps your shoelace from unraveling. So that cap is a certain length when the cell is young, but with each replication and division of that cell, it gets a little shorter and a little shorter. So it's literally like the biological clock of the cell, a chromosomal marker for aging. And what research has shown us is that kids in very stressed environments, compared to kids who were in those environments but got into more nurturing environments, those kids who stayed in those deprived settings, their telomeres were literally shorter even by age 9. So they were biologically aging. They were prematurely aging faster than a like group of kids. And so if you extrapolate that over a lifetime of just 40 or 50 years, that's how come you see the diseases of age start coming earlier in life. And so the relationship of this and stress is that long-term exposure to the stress hormone, cortisol, leads to reduced telomere length, and the reduced telomere length also is associated with higher risk for cardiovascular disease, stroke, cancer, etc. So that's how we see this relationship that we saw from looking at young children and later disease. Which brings us to this other word, which I think will become more mainstream in the near years to come, but it's called epigenetics. And this is really the interplay between genes and experience, or genes and environment. So it's really the on-off switch of which of your genes get expressed. Because you may have the gene for diabetes, but you're not necessarily going to have diabetes unless that gene gets expressed. And one of the ways it gets expressed is based on your diet, your health habits, your exercise, etc. So that interplay is really why we say that genes may load the gun, but your experiences pulls the trigger. And it's why for children their experiences are so critical, because a group of children with the same risk factors are going to have very different outcomes based on their experiences. So bringing this back to Chicago now, let's think about the stress that our children in Chicago may face. And we know the ultimate stressor, right, kind of violence. Or in this case, this is a map of Chicago, obviously, broken down by neighborhoods. And what we did at Erickson was want to look at what are the number of children under the age 5 who live in areas that are experiencing high levels of murder. So these are the murders that took place in 2016. So the darker the color, the more murders it had, right? So the median number of murders was 6 in 2016 in a given neighborhood. So if you are 6 or more, you are a shaded color, and the darker the shade, the more murders you had. And then what we do there is pull out the number of young children under age 5 in each of these neighborhoods. And you may not be able to see all the numbers from where you are, but believe it or not, there's 97,000, right? Almost 100,000 children under the age of 5 who live in a neighborhood that had 6 or more murders. So what do we do about that? What do we need to do? Well, what would we do for our children, right? We would intervene before there was a problem. We would know that that is a real threat to our child's development. And so we really have to respond to the mental health needs of a community in a very preventive manner before children start exhibiting behaviors, conduct disorder, school failure, other problems. Like, we know that you cannot be exposed to that level of violence and not have a reaction. The research tells us that, but any of you in your life, you know that too, just knowing how you would react and what you would do for your children if that kind of violence was near your doorsteps. So let's talk about school readiness, because we've talked about the individual now, and I really want to talk about what we need to do for our individual children in terms of getting them ready for school, because I think it's very different than what we often think about. So I want to talk about executive function and self-regulation. So executive function may be a term we've heard, and there's a lot of jargon that I could throw at you to define that. But I will translate it to these three simple words. It's planning, reasoning, and problem solving, right? These are the tasks that we really have to do as adults in our work life, and ultimately our children have to do it too in a way that I want to demonstrate. And so this is really important as I explain the research that tells us how important executive function is. And the best way I can explain this is to have all of you use your executive function skills right here and right now. So we'll do a little audience participation. So if you would all take a fork or knife or a pen, or if they're all very dirty, you can just tap your hand on your hip. But I'm going to tap on this microphone. So when I tap once, I want you to tap twice. And when I tap twice, I'd like you to tap once. So I know that maybe sounds a little scary, and everyone just had like a cortisol rush of stress to deal with that. But 4.5-year-old children can do this, so everyone can just relax. That's not meant to put pressure on you. That's meant to just alleviate the pressure. So don't look at your neighbor. Just worry about yourself. And I'm going to tap once, and you tap twice, and when I tap twice, you tap once. Okay? Okay, it's a very good crowd here. Jay, you got very, very, very attentive people. Okay, so what you were doing there to follow me was use your executive function skills. Because what did you have to do? First of all, I could feel you all listening really hard and concentrating. And concentrating means you were inhibiting your impulse, which was to mimic me and copy me. Then you had to remember what that rule was. I tap twice, you tap once. I tap once, you tap twice. And then you had to apply that rule. So you had to kind of block out all the other things that you kind of intuitively wanted to do. That is the same thing we do with our children when they're learning the alphabet, right? They're told each of these 26 letters has a different sound, except a letter like C, which really sounds like a K, except when it sounds like an S. And you have to remember all that and know when to, like, switch the letter. And a word like tail, which we're telling our kids not to pull the tail on their pets at home, but if we're going to read them a fairy tale, that's all wonderful. And those are two different words, but they sound exactly the same to that child, of course. And a number like zero, a digit, like zero means one thing when it's alone, and it means something else when it follows another digit. So all of these things are with us our whole life, where we're constantly having to manage all that. That is executive function. So now that we all know that, we can simply understand that executive function abilities predict academic and school readiness for school over and above intelligence, over and above prior academic knowledge. So it's not about, did you attend 3 or 4 years of preschool before you got to kindergarten or whatever? It's what are the skills you're bringing with you? Now, hopefully the preschool teaches you these skills. But this over-focus that many of us have as parents, the over-focus that the schools have on literacy and cognition, that's not the skills you necessarily need. Kindergarten teachers will tell you the skills their students need are to be able to pay attention, get along with others, follow directions. If they can do that, they can teach them anything they need to learn. They don't need to walk in the door at kindergarten with those skills. The research is quite profound. So this is a National Academy of Sciences study, and there was lots of research I could show you, and I'm just going to show you the results of one study because this is longitudinal. The graph I'm going to show you up here is from these kids who are now 32 years of age. But what they did is they did a measure of self-regulation, which is very similar to executive function, and it assessed them at age 3, 5, 7, 9, and 11. So you have multiple points with these kids, and you assess their self-regulation throughout their childhood, and then they get a composite score from 1, which would be really low, all the way up to 5, which would be high. Now look at, based on how they had self-regulation as a kid, look at their outcomes at age 32 in terms of their health. So as you see the line go down, that means they had less health complications, substance dependence, much less substance dependence, all correlated back with their self-regulation as a kid. Their wealth, meaning their ability to hold a job and a better paying job, see almost a direct linear relationship. Adult criminal conviction, you see dramatic reductions based on their self-regulation as a child, and single parent child rearing. Almost 60% if you had low self-regulation as a child, and about half of that if you had high self-regulation. So ultimately, this isn't really a surprise, because going back even to the year 2000, we have definition from the National Research Council and Institute of Medicine about what is school readiness. And it's acquiring self-regulation, emotions, behaviors, and attention. It's your ability to communicate and learn, your language, reason, and problem solving, and your ability to get along with others, which is based on the relationships you have as an infant and toddler, which teaches you how to have relationships with other people and get along with others. So now let's look at the schools in general and how they're doing, because we put a lot of responsibility on our schools to get our kids to achieve academically, yet the schools aren't really involved in the early childhood period. So they have to get in after this early childhood period, and they're responsible for what happens. So there's some really fascinating research that's come out from Stanford University and Sean Reardon. He looked at 300 million records of school test scores over a five-year period. And so what this dotted line is essentially where you would expect kids to be at third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, et cetera, all the way up to eighth grade. So if you're above that line, you're exceeding grade level expectations. If you're below that line, you're lagging behind the expectations. So I want to show you a couple different communities. So let's talk about Evanston, which is where I live, and a kind of prize community for educational achievement. And you see that at third grade, the kids are above the third grade level, and they have a nice trajectory up till eighth grade, where they're about the 10th grade level. So very steady progress. A little different story if you look at the same kids in Evanston, but divided by the poor kids, which are lagging third grade level at third grade and almost make up that difference by eighth grade. But you see the school system closed most of the gap, but they were starting with a gap at third grade. The non-poor kids, which are some of the best in the country, were far above the third grade level at third grade, and then still obviously far above at eighth grade. But look at the slopes of those lines. They're parallel. So they're increasing at the same rate. So the school system educated those kids equally, right? The non-poor kids didn't increase that gap. It just sustained. So the gap that was there at third grade is still there at eighth grade. So let's talk about CPS. This is what CPS looks like. So CPS at third grade, those kids are testing at the second grade level. But over the next 5 years, they receive the equivalent of 6 years of education. So that by eighth grade, they've almost caught up. The gaps were clear at third grade. They're almost closed at eighth grade. They're still there. I'll bring this all together here in a moment. So this is all the school districts in the country. This is 11,000 school districts. The red dots are the non-poor districts. The yellow dots are the poor districts. So you want to be higher up on this chart. So obviously the red dots are doing better than the white dots. That's pure academic achievement. The non-poor communities are doing better. But let's look at growth. Now the dots are like laying on top of each other. That's because the growth is essentially the same. The school systems are educating poor and non-poor kids essentially equally across the country. It's not the story we hear, right? Academic achievement is higher academic achievement is achieved by the non-poor kids, but that's because they were starting better off before third grade. The schools took them and did exactly what they were designed to do, which was educate them, essentially a year at a time, sometimes a little bit more so. So getting back to Chicago, now this is all 11,000 school districts, but the white dots here are the Illinois school districts. The biggest dot is CPS because the size of the dot is the number of kids in the school district. And you see here that CPS is doing better than Evanston. That dot is higher from that middle line there, which means the growth in CPS is faster growth than what's happening in Evanston, right? So CPS, in fact, was the best large school district in the United States in terms of growth. Of the 200 largest school districts, CPS did the best, but they could not close that achievement gap completely, the gap that existed before those kids even got into third grade. Because we have to recognize that those third grade test scores are a measure of how we have supported our children during the first years of life. So two huge takeaways here. The story we've heard about CPS is a lot more complex than just academic achievement. If we talk about academic growth, they're not only doing well, they're literally doing the best in the country, according to this data from Stanford University. And if we really want to close achievement gaps, we have to start before these kids get into school, because that gap is there from the earliest years. And the schools we have, the system we have, was not designed to close the gap. It was designed to educate the kids they get. So ultimately, it's great that Chicago is moving forward with universal pre-K. That's the ambition, and wants to get to three-year-olds as well. But all of that needs to be done yesterday, just as New York City is doing. But even if we get to pre-K and 3K, that is insufficient, because that's just the education part. And early childhood education is a piece. It's ultimately about early childhood experience. And if we focus only on education, we will fail to move the needle. We have to do more. And what I mean by that is everything I talked about with the mental health services in a very preventive way, but also home visiting, high quality childcare before they get to pre-K and 3K, paid parental leave. Those are just examples, right? We don't have a system focused on young children. We have a plethora of services that are barely scratching the tip of the iceberg, but we don't have a systemic approach yet. We keep taking little baby steps in that direction, but we have to have a wholesale review of the choices we make about how we prepare our kids for life. Which brings me to this final section, which is this notion that we can't afford to do more. But we have to understand that that statement is a choice, because we really do decide how we allocate the resources we have. And we have chosen to say we can't afford to do more. So if we looked at the 31 most developed economies in this country, and we looked at their GDP and a percentage of GDP that they spend to educate their young children, this would be just a sampling of them. And to give you context, right, so these two bars in the middle, that's the average of all of these 31 countries, which is 0.7%, and the European Union countries, which is 0.7%. So where's the United States there? We're not in the top. We're not in the middle. We are just above Turkey in spending 0.3%, 0.3 of 1% to prepare our children in the earliest years. So that's a choice. And to give you an example of that choice, when we decide that we want factories and jobs, right, we go out and make it happen. We find the money. Wisconsin wanted that Foxconn factory because it was going to bring jobs. They found $3 billion to make that happen. And that was going to get 13,000 jobs. And whenever I read that, I just do the math. Divide. That means each one of those jobs is worth $230,000 to us. We don't need that much money to educate all these kids. But we say we do need that money for these jobs. So that is a choice, and we have to recognize those choices. Because ultimately, it's the first 1,100 days from birth till the third birthday that is the foundation of a child's life. And it's what I say is our window of opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nagel. And now we're ready for some questions. If anybody has a question, our staff is... there's one down here and one back there, Alex. Great. Thank you, Miles.
Can I just shout out? Can you hear me?
Michael, if you're going to make a long statement, no. If it's a question, fine. You know the rules of the City Club.
My name is Michael Razalowski. I'm an individual member. My presentation is, other than saying we're throwing money at the problem, isn't how we volunteer and how we interact with the community a major component of why the poor community has their problems? Mm-hmm.
Jeff?
Yeah. Can you say that question again? I'm not sure I fully understand that.
Part of the problem is money.
Yeah.
But part of the problem is access. I mean, there are people who live on the West Side And because of how we handle our society, they get isolated from other people. The easiest example is jobs. If some kid is going to high school on the west side of the city of Chicago, who do they know? Where are they going to get a job? If a kid is going to Utrecht and he needs a job after high school or during the summer, how many opportunities does that kid have?
Yeah, I mean, opportunities are a huge part of the equation. But part of being able to seize the opportunity is, what are you prepared to do once you get the opportunity? And so this is about, getting kids prepared and the foundation. And so the notion is, what part of your life in any area that you do that you wouldn't want as strong a foundation as possible, either in your personal life or in the home that you live in or anything? And whatever weaknesses you have in your foundation, in your upbringing, in your home, you know you have to compensate for those. And that's just part of life. And we do that every day on many different levels. Some of the kids just have a lot more they have to compensate for. And until we really systematically set out to address that, we're constantly going to be dealing with, you know, kids who have tremendous challenges and deficits that they have to overcome, so that even if opportunities present themselves, are they going to be prepared to walk through those doors?
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Michael. This is from Josh Kaufman, who's with Teach Plus Illinois. His question is, what are the biggest issues facing the development of a highly skilled early childhood educator workforce that can meet the needs of children in Illinois?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I mean, so much of what Erickson does is about preparing the workforce, right? So we believe that if you prepare the workforce, if you prepare the professionals, that's how we're best positioned to really support family well-being and support thriving communities. So it's a constant challenge because it's the lowest paid field, and the prospects of changing that are very slim. And so you get very impassioned, very committed people to this work, but you know you're going to have a lot of debt in terms of the education you're going to have to fund, and then how you're going to be remunerated for that in the work that you do. So we've seen great reductions in the demand for certain types of education, early childhood education, the field, people coming into that field to be teachers, early childhood education teachers, dramatic reductions in demand for that, both on the bachelor level and the graduate level. So this is a huge issue because it is about the workforce. So even if we had all the money in the world, we don't have the right workforce. And so, again, if you have a system, you fund the system appropriately, you bring people in who you support their educational attainment, but then you also support them with the appropriate wage. And right now, that's not there. And so there's a lot that would have to change rather than just money into the system. It's structural, systemic changes that have to take place as well.
Thank you. This is from Holly Wallace with the Housing Authority of Cook County. What's the most compelling argument to convince impoverished parents to enroll their children in an early education program?
Well, that's such a great question. I just think ultimately whatever you do in a community has to be with the community, by the community. And, I've been fortunate to work at great institutions like Tulane University and Erickson, and the trap that you can fall into is to be part of the ivory tower. And how do you really get connected to the community so that you're a part of that community and the community is really leading the initiative? And so that's a big part of the work that we've undertaken now at Erickson as we do more and more work in the community. You know, we have our mental health clinic, which is at Erickson. We have funding to bring that clinic out to Little Village, and so we'll be bringing that, to the community in a way that we've never been able to do before. We have other initiatives that's really trying to engage with the community so that we can build the solutions together and then implement the solutions. But it is very difficult if you just think, we will build it and they will come. It's much more complicated than that, so your question is right on.
Thank you. This is from Marge Muchen-Goldblatt with IFF, City Club member. Is Erickson focusing on early detection of ADHD, impulsivity, or anxiety? Do you think it can be detected before age 5?
I wouldn't say that we would focus on that. I would say that we are we have a mental health clinic at Erickson, so that if parents are concerned about their children with any of those issues, anxiety, ADHD, any other issues in early childhood, you can come to Erickson for assessment. You can come to Erickson potentially for treatment. You can, you know, help get a understanding of what's really happening, and we will work with you on that. So it does get diagnosed in kids that age, but, you know, for the larger policy issue is it gets overdiagnosed in kids that age. And we have way too many kids that are being medicated, and we have way too many people doing the diagnoses that are not really qualified to do that. So it is a tricky issue. It does get back to the workforce issue and the training issues. So it is complicated. But, you know, the good news, Erickson is a gem in this city and has been for many years. And one of the great parts of Erickson is our mental health clinic to help families really understand what is happening with their children. It's an area that for us has grown dramatically because there's just incredible demand. So it's an area we want to keep meeting that demand, which is why I said we're, you know, literally trying to extend our services, not just by offering them at Erickson, but also in the community and starting in Little Village, hopefully in about 6 weeks.
Great. I'm going to combine a couple of questions here because they're very closely related, from Melissa Harris and from Robin Steens. How does the new federal tax bill affect children? What are the implications for early childhood, if any?
Yeah, that's a great question because it's major policy that's going to affect the country, you know, for years and years to come. And I think the question is, does the tax bill invest in children? And unfortunately, the answer is no. There's nothing about the tax bill that inherently increases our investment in our children. And in fact, may actually undermine our investments in our children. So right now, the child health insurance program in the country, which provides health insurance to 9 million children of the working poor, these are kids that don't qualify for Medicaid, which is for the quote-unquote poor, but these are kids at a little bit higher income. So 9 million children, that program expired in September or October, and it has not been reauthorized. This was something that was created in the late 90s, has been, you know, a huge success in our country in terms of lowering the uninsured rate for children from 15% to 5%. And that has not been renewed. And Orrin Hatch, who's the senator from Utah, is the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, said we cannot renew that right now because we do not have the money for that anymore. And one of the reasons we do not have the money for that is because we're going to reduce government by $1.5 trillion through this tax bill. And we've already seen what the budget outline is to address that decrease in revenue for the government, which is to reduce Medicaid over 10 years, reduce food stamps, supplemental nutrition assistance program, reduce supports of the social safety net. And the child health insurance is a prime example of that. So unfortunately, you know, separate from whether you feel this tax bill is good or bad or should we or shouldn't we reform taxes, the reality is there will be trade-offs on the other side. An additional one is, you know, whether or not you can deduct state and local taxes. If it remains that you will not be able to do that, that's going to have a tremendous impact on local funding for schools because schools are basically funded by local tax dollars and state, $600 billion. Which is 10 times more than what we do for young children. So $600 billion, which are state and local, there's going to be ramifications if you can't deduct that on your taxes. Communities will feel a lot of pressure to reduce their tax burden, and some will and some won't. So I would say, you know, overall for children, you know, less investment in our kids as a result of the pending tax legislation.
Excellent. We've got some great questions here today. This is terrific. This is from Catherine, if I mispronounce your last name. I'm not sure if it's Benzing or Benzinger. Anyhow, do you think a stigma exists when we say parenting education is the most important early childhood experience that will close the achievement gap?
Well, I think it's all how you say it and who you say it to. clearly, that can come as quite a loaded statement, but, you know, there's certain, you know, that's a fact. On every level, to any socioeconomic parent you're talking to, that is an accurate statement. Because ultimately, and again, you know, my first slide was, it's about early experience. And how do young children experience the world? They experience it through relationships. And that relationship is usually with a parent. And if that parent is a better educated, better informed parent, meaning they understand the needs of their children and they can read the cues of their children well, they're going to be able to have a very healthy relationship with their child, and that child's going to have many more positive experiences through that relationship. So it's a great statement, it's true, but how we use it and how we say it, it definitely can stigmatize.
Okay. Two questions here, both good questions from Michelle Deneen White, who's not a member of the City Club, but I'm going to work both questions in, so consider becoming a member, Michelle. Highly irregular. Her question is there support for outreach groups and other nonprofits trying to facilitate family engagement and increase early childhood learning experiences in non-traditional settings such as daycare centers, libraries, other community organizations? And her bottom line is, how can we help each other to better support vulnerable families?
So one of those questions is typed. I don't know how that gets it home.
So people can phone in questions she decided it was so important to come here and see and listen to you in person that she has a blue slip and a white slip.
Yeah, that's great. So is there support? I've been in Chicago for 4 years, and I am blown away by the engagement of the philanthropic community and the philanthropic and generosity of individuals in this town. So there is a ton of support. Is it enough to really, you know, change things? I don't know, and maybe not. But there is support. We need more. And I don't think that support alone is going to do the trick, right? So it has to change on many levels. The system has to change, therefore that's policy issues. It's why we do the policy work that we do at Erickson and partner with the many other organizations in this town that Irving Harris helped start and others that really do focus on this important work. So it's got to be at every level, from the community up, from the ground up, from every child care center across. So overall, I would say tremendous support, but we need a lot more.
And Jeff, one last question. You mentioned that people who work in this field, these dedicated professionals, people here, are frequently among the lowest paid. If there were advances in compensation, remuneration, and that, what sort of effect do you think that would have on the subject?
Yeah, if it was a better paid field, I think we'd attract more people. We would attract diversity, which means male and female. It's a female-dominated field at this point, and I think if we had more males, that would be wonderful for everyone involved, especially the children. That is a great world to think about. However, we have to understand that it's a market-based system right now, meaning most of early education, early childhood services are private pay. And they're exceedingly expensive. High-quality child care, if it costs you $200 a week, which would be a bargain in some parts of town, that's $10,000 a year. And if you have more than one child, you do the math. So it's a lot of money. It's a lot of after-tax money. And it's, you know, people, mainly younger people, earlier in their money-earning days, that have to spend that money. So, again, I don't think it can just survive as a market-based system. There's got to be a different approach to this that would really change things, that would then change the compensation model.
Okay, one last question. This is from Jordan Hauk, who's a guest of the ADA. He's a young person. He's a future physician who attended college and med school in Chicago. Where are you, Jordan? Oh, he's right back there. Or is it she? Sorry. There aren't too many fellows here today, Jay, you know. This is amazing. It's great. Because my guess is in 1903, when the City Club first started, there were probably absolutely zero females at many of their meetings. This is fantastic. Anyhow, Jordan, as a young person and future physician who attended college and medical school in Chicago, she'd like to know how we could get today's message to other people like her, to those who may have never heard of the Erickson Institute, but would like to get behind what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the great challenge. And so you come to the City Club and you get to address a whole new group of people. That's a struggle that we face, not just at Erickson, but everyone in our field. It's not just the work that we're doing, the reasons behind it, the science behind it. There's lots of great organizations in Chicago that are doing this. So much of what's happening in the country has emanated out of Chicago. But, you know, to a certain extent, there's a, you know, huge support for pre-K out there, but that has become like the easy thing to achieve. And even if we got to universal pre-K across the country, that's not really going to change things, because that's just moving the K-12 system down a year to four-year-olds. So we still have a tremendous amount of work to do to really change the collective consciousness of our society to say, no, we're going to invest in our kids. Because we have to realize that this K-12 system that we live, the world that we live in today, is a relic of the late 1600s. And, you know, knowing what we know now about development, knowing what we know now about what the family looks like, right? In the 60s, 40% of women worked. Now 70% mothers. 40% of mothers worked. Now 70% work. Single mothers, 75% work. Single fathers, 83%. It's a different world. And we haven't adapted to that. And our children, you know, carry that on their shoulders. So we have to make that change. That's what we try to do at Erickson every day. That's what, you know, gets us coming to work every day. And we're determined to keep moving forward. So if we've gained some new people who are excited about that, Jordan, we're glad to have you aboard, and we'll look forward to working with you.
Absolutely. Folks, let's give Dr. Nagel a big round of applause.